Hello and welcome to Consumer, a podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I am your guest host today, Yael Ososki, filling in for my colleague Bill Vietz, joined as always by Billy Joel, feeding out into the background. Thanks so much for joining us today. There's a couple things I wanted to get to. Bill is taking some time off. The man needs it. He's been providing great interviews, great content here the last couple of weeks, and definitely proud of the work that Bill has been able to do in building this podcast now over several episodes. So if you do want to go check those out, our link is in the description. You can find that there. We've already had 30 episodes over the course of the past few months. It has been great, and Bill has done a great job. He's been able to cover a lot of topics, everything related to COVID, to the European Union's green regulation, to minimum taxes, definitely has covered harm reduction and vaping in the last couple of weeks as well, and many of the shenanigans. So to give you a preview of what we'll discuss today, we're going to go through a couple of clips that we're playing. We're going to kind of shake it up a little bit today and discuss what's happening with the European Union and digital policy tech regulation. This is a big deal. It's something that impacts consumers and users throughout the European Union and has been a huge problem in terms of figuring out how consumers are going to be best served by many of the regulations, by many of the taxes, and by many of the fines and various actions done by European institutions to try to hamper some of the technology companies. So we'll go through a little bit of that, and then we're going to play some clips, part of an interview that we conducted with Danish political economist and commentator Bjørn Lomborg. He gives us a little bit of insight on what's happening with the Green New Deal, any of the green deals that we see that are being discussed in the European Union. And we know that the European Commission will be dropping its climate plan finally next week here in mid-July. I'm sure there's a lot of people attuned. They're not sweating through the incredibly high temperatures throughout Europe right now. So I hope you guys are staying cool right now. But let's go ahead and play some of these clips. We've got the first one that we want to look at. Let's look at the war on Apple. Now, this one is interesting. When we look at what's happening in the European Commission and we see the various fines, we see the various levies and things that are brandished, it's often done in the name of the consumer. And this is exactly what's happening with Apple. But as we know, it's a bit more complicated than that.
The EU, meantime, is accusing Apple of setting restrictive terms on the App Store. Our Josh Lipton has all the latest. Hey, Josh.
So, Carl, the European Commission has now issued what it calls a statement of objections, a preliminary finding that Apple says distorts competition in the music streaming market and abuses its dominant position in the distribution of music streaming apps through its App Store. Here is Margaret Vestager, Executive VP of the EC, on this news.
App Store rules are a concern for many app developers beyond music streaming, because they depend on the Apple App Store as a gatekeeper to access users of Apple's iPhones and iPads. And this significant market power cannot go unchecked.
Remember, this case started with Spotify, which of course competes with Apple's music streaming service. For its part, Apple is not backing down one bit, saying the commission's argument on Spotify's behalf is the opposite of fair competition.
So let's unpack this a little bit. This relates to the Digital Markets Act, a current legislative proposal that is being discussed by both European Council, European Parliament, who are the ones who will have to pass what the European Commission has put forward. They put forward this sort of plan, sketched it out in December 2020, and now we have the various committees who have been marking it up. You have various stakeholders who provided some comments. We at the Consumer Choice Center have also provided comment on this. We kind of know what this is about. It really has very little to do with actual concerns about consumers and whether they're being harmed. It has everything to do with trying to essentially halt, stop, or rein in or restrict many of these tech companies, which so happen to be American. It's not the first time that the European Commission has put forward these type of arguments, and in the specific example of streaming, particularly music, they're targeting Apple, which does not have the dominant position when it comes to actual music streaming services. That is Spotify, which is a Swedish firm, now very well known. Also in the American market, is actually doing a lot of great work in terms of providing great value and algorithms to figure out which type of music people want to listen to. And Apple is doing much the same. However, Apple is the one being targeted in this letter. And this is where the ire of the European Commission is at the moment. It's these kind of initiatives that really make one cynical about much of this approach, because it has nothing to do with harm. It has to do with perceived harm through, quote, monopolization, through monopolies. But looking at audio streaming, if you have Spotify that has, as far as we know, 55% of the share of the EU market, isn't that exactly what the European Union should be in favor of? Is a European company, a European firm that has a majority stake in the streaming market? We need to have more competitors, no doubt. And how will the law actually provide that? And this specific targeting of Apple Music, which really does not have anywhere near the majority and is in fact a minority adopted service for audio streaming, it seems as if it's just a nationalistic play. I think this falls far too often onto the game plan of what's happening in many of these European institutions, and they always claim that it's for figuring out how to do the best service for European consumers and users, but far too often they're using these very complicated mechanisms and taxes and levies and fines going after specifically American tech firms. Now, they're American tech firms, that's where they're founded, that's where they're based, but they do have many offices across the EU, across Europe. They do, in most circumstances, attempt to try to get in, you know, some kind of compliance with the various national rules or EU rules. There's a lot of that happens, but it's not just Apple. It's not just audio streaming. As we know, there's a lot more that's happening in the antitrust field, and they have another company in their crosshairs, and that's Google.
Regulators in the European Union have launched a new antitrust investigation into Google. They're looking at whether the company favors its own ad buying services and restricts rivals. The EU already fined Google nearly $10 billion in three other cases.
Now, this is the one area that I've written a lot about. You can check out some of the articles on consumerchoicecenter.org. And I still have very hard times understanding this argument. What the European Commission in this case is saying, and what the antitrust investigation is all about, has everything to do with the various competitors that Google allows onto its own platform, specifically when it comes to buying advertising. If any of you have used the Google Ad platform, that's one of many platforms that people can use, and Google on its own services favors that because of better integration. It's seamless. You can connect the various products. Anyone who uses the Google Analytics code is able to match that to the ads, and that's the value that is provided. I never understand this argument about how a company that's created a platform out of nothing, they've created it, they've provided it to consumers, they have these various services. Of course they're going to favor the thing that they themselves created, that many of the people who created the search engines are also working on the teams to deliver the various ad booking services. This is not controversial. This is exactly what any company would do. If a tire store is able to come up with his own version of tires, you better bet they're going to sell their tires. They're not required by some law of the market, that they have to offer every brand available. They're able to provide their platform so that they can sell those other products if they want to, but Google doesn't have to, much like Apple doesn't have to in its iOS store. And I think this is part of the very problematic logic when it comes to the new technological innovation meshing with the old school political institutions that don't necessarily understand technology, nor do they really calculate the benefit to users and consumers. Us at the Consumer Choice Center, we use a lot of different tech platforms and tools, and there are a lot of them that work very well and some that don't work very well. And sometimes we will use something that is inherent to the platform. Maybe we will use a Google Analytics. Maybe we will use the Google Ad platform. But at the same time, we use other platforms, we use other services, and that's the great part about having a competitive and innovative market. This kind of antitrust action is not what antitrust is about. Antitrust is about figuring out where monopolies exist and where there are actual harms to the consumer. Are there harms to the consumer? We'll see what's proved in this case and in this investigation. I tend to doubt that, but you know, this is the kind of issue that we're facing today. Is it might seem like it's a lot about companies and it's about technologies and it's about various policies, but it has a lot to do with the countries involved and where those companies are based. And that was the question that was asked to Margarete Vestager, who is the vice president there of the commission. She's the chief antitrust operator, if we can call her this. And she was asked why the European Union is investing so much time, energy, and money into investigating American tech firms while leaving the Chinese tech firms, things like TikTok, that have immense power, specifically among you Zoomers out there who are using it. Why aren't they focusing on these firms that do have a fairly dominant position now, that have probably nowhere near the same level of data policies, of strict regulations, and who definitely don't have the same type of care of data and personal privacy as these other apps?
Second thing is that we should not redo each other's investigations, because markets are different, the legal framework is different. That you will see even with jurisdictions at the US and the European Union, that even though we have a very, very close cooperation and have had it for decades, we don't necessarily do the same cases because the market situation may be different and the legal framework that we work in may be different.
Now, this is very interesting because, as we know, there is a new administration in the United States, that of Democratic President Joe Biden. He has empowered the American Federal Trade Commission to weaponize its own tools to go against tech companies. And there are various hearings and there are various actions that are being taken, various lawsuits that have been filed, many of which have actually not been successful. Specifically, there was one against Facebook that was drawn up both by the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. and various attorneys generals. These are sort of the chief lawyers, the chief law enforcement officers of each state. 46 of them came together in a lawsuit, and a judge said no, because they could not prove that they actually had a monopoly, and they could not prove that consumers had been harmed by such. So that's kind of what's happening there, and that's somewhat different to what happened in the previous administration with Donald Trump. Obviously, he is, as a private citizen now, he issued his own lawsuit against specifically Twitter and Facebook for questions on content. That's a whole other issue. But at least his department was not as, we'll say hammer ready to go after many of these tech firms, because they do somewhat believe in innovation and they did somewhat believe in protecting the American system. But that's neither here nor there. There's going to be a lot more to come on this topic, specifically when it comes to tech regulation and to the Digital Markets Act. It's something that we're very passionate about at the Consumer Choice Center. We do believe it will impact hundreds of millions of people across the European Union. And we have to really understand what is at stake here and what is actually being proposed by some of these institutions, some of the definitions that they come with. One of the interesting definitions that I found in reading through this was the idea of gatekeepers. This is gatekeepers are sort of how many of these tech companies have been defined. And, you know, I should note that many of the companies that are being targeted in the Digital Markets Act are those that only have, I believe it's something around $10 billion in revenue and a certain number of users. And as far as my reading was, it's only about 10 companies, mostly American, again. And in these circumstances, when we have various politicians that are cobbling these rules together, both in the commission and with the parliament that's able to add these various amendments and have these committee hearings, we have to understand, how are consumers going to be impacted on this? Are they going to actually have a hand up? Will there be more competition? In this, you cannot see this as anything more than a lot of protectionism on the part of the Europeans. And there's a lot of arguments to be made about why we don't have large European tech companies like they do in the United States. It's a big question to ask, and it's one that we have to continue providing the analysis for in saying that what these companies need, what any startup needs, is they need a smart regulatory environment where they know they're not going to be targeted by many of these institutions, whether it be years down the line or even at the beginning, to try to provide their services to users and consumers. So a lot of the platforms that are being looked at in the Digital Markets Act are the search engines, social networks, video sharing platforms, communications platforms, operating systems, and they're going to have a battle with basically every company and every service. So look for that. It's going to come against Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Amazon is going to be a big one that they're going to go after. This is all really going to impact a lot of our experience online. It's important that we continue to focus on this, continue to provide some perspective, and I know that Bill, your usual host here on the Consumer Podcast, will continue to do so. Let's change gears here, looking at everything that's happening to climate. Climate is an important concern of many European regulators. It surely always takes the cake in terms of Brussels politics in the bubble, and there's a lot that has been promoted and a lot that has been introduced. And later we'll actually play some clips with a political scientist, commentator, writer, all around climate extraordinaire Bjorn Lomborg. But first, let's play a couple of clips to give some context to this. This is actually from the Greens in the European Parliament. They make a point about transportation and planes. They're all in on trains, as you can guess. But let's listen to this little social media ad that they put together to give us an idea as to what the continued green agenda might be in the European Union and how it impacts you, the consumer.
Since the start of COVID-19, €42 billion of taxpayers' money has been used to bail out airline companies with no strings attached. Airlines want to go back to business as usual. But business as usual isn't good for us or for the planet. Cheap airfares mask the true cost of flying to society, with air and noise pollution, high emissions, and poor working conditions.
Nope. Oh, looks like we're back on going against the cheap flights that many Europeans use. This is, again, typical of the kind of playbook of going after the cheap airfare that actually affords many flights for people who are of lower income throughout the European bloc. People are able to take holidays and vacations using services like Wizz Air or Ryanair or some of these discount services because they offer lower prices. This is obviously seen as bad. But let's continue on because we got to promote a little bit of trains, don't we?
But there is another way. Trains are a fast, comfortable, and green alternative. With trains, you don't need to spend hours going through security. There are less luggage restrictions. You can take your bike and pets on board. You can hop on in the city centre and even go to sleep and wake up at your destination. Though better for people and the planet, trains are at a disadvantage. Airlines are exempt from paying tax on the fuel they burn. And this is unfair. Everyone else pays tax on their fuel. A recent poll showed 72% of EU citizens agree that airlines should be required to pay tax on the fuel they use. Politicians should follow the lead of the people and not that of the aviation lobby. We can build a greener transport system, but we need fair competition. Let's call on European politicians to end tax benefits for polluters.
So as sensationalistic as this Green Party ad is, there is something that we can probably say about the taxation rules, specifically when it comes to the jet fuels. Any of these tax discrepancies, yes, that is something that is a problem. And, is it totally fair? Probably not. There's not really a good argument for bailing out many of these airlines. I know Bill has specifically mentioned this a good amount. We've had this debate in many other jurisdictions and countries as well. It's not the place of the government nor taxpayers to bail out airlines that have failed. There's all types of debates that we can have on that, but I think I would probably agree with their point. However, switching over to a total endorsement of trains really just neglects the idea that we have fair competition rules for trains anyway. As we've mentioned on this program before and as many different interviews that Bill has been able to conduct shows, the rules are also in favor of the incumbent train companies, whom most of the time, usually, are the state monopolies, and the state monopolies are able to continue. I mean, where's the antitrust regulator on that? We've heard a little bit from some of the European institutions on the train rule specifically. When it comes to bashing the airlines, this is something that you're not going to really find any opposition from many of us at the Consumer Choice Center. They have made many bad decisions, and surely there are many areas where they could provide better service and could provide better consumer choice. That we know. However, completely upending it and saying that we need to do everything in our power to use the force of our European institutions to make it so that we favor train travel is just not realistic. It's not realistic because we don't have the network. We don't have the cheap prices that are available to those who take those flights, as I mentioned. And when it comes to the bailouts of the airline companies, we should note that some companies like Ryanair actually very much lobbied against many of these bailouts. That's something that is never really discussed in this. It's not really brought up in the point because it does not really play into the broader environmental message on this. So that's one view from the Green Party, from the Green Parliamentary Group. But let's get a little bit of analysis here. This is going to be a joint clip. This is we have Ursula von der Leyen. She's the head of the European Commission, and she's announcing this new breakthrough fund cooperation with none other than Bill Gates, who I guess is having his company put in the crosshairs over on the antitrust space. But still, he's willing to partner with the European Commission on this project. This has everything to do with green investments and the future of energy and innovation.
The European Green Deal is our blueprint for Europe to become the first climate-neutral continent by 2050. It strives for systemic change and modernization across our economy, our societies, and industry. Of course, energy transition is at its heart, and this is why I warmly welcome the opportunity to join forces with Breakthrough Energy.
All right, let's do a little pause there. So Breakthrough Energy is a sort of an umbrella name of various organizations founded by Bill Gates. The idea is to invest in innovative, sustainable energies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Absolutely nothing wrong with this. It seems that they're also looking at nuclear fission, different batteries for renewable energy and biofuels. So they're going through a whole approach. They're not just looking at only solar and wind, which have not provided that great energy, as we'll learn later from Bjorn Lomborg. But this is fairly interesting. This is a personal investment by Bill Gates. Started this of $2 billion, and he's been able to recruit a lot of different people. Our favorite person, Michael Bloomberg. We can talk about that some other time. Jeff Bezos is also involved. Richard Branson, George Soros, Jack Ma. Actually, Mark Zuckerberg. So there has been a fair amount of investment on this side, and the idea is to try to find what those technologies will be in the future to provide those net zero, zero carbon goals. I know Bill has covered that very intensely the past couple of weeks, and there's a lot to say about it. But this is interesting, the approach of the European Commission. Let's continue to play the clip. I think Bill Gates is now going to jump in.
I am excited to announce a new partnership between Breakthrough Energy and the European Commission. I've created Breakthrough Energy Catalyst, a first-of-its-kind innovative finance vehicle designed to rapidly commercialize critical climate-smart technologies. To succeed in preventing the climate crisis, the world will need a new approach to building global industries. This is the greatest opportunity for innovation the world has ever seen.
The Catalyst program is targeting the technologies we need for Europe to become carbon neutral. We want to deploy InvestEU with the European Investment Bank and, I hope, national financial partners. And on top, InvestEU allows member states to mobilize funds, for example, from EU programs like Next Generation EU.
So this is interesting. This is a different method of investing in the so-called net zero, carbon zero movement. There's a lot of stuff that will come through with the climate target plan for 2030. Again, as I mentioned, it will be officially introduced by next week, so we'll have more of an idea of how they were able to take some of the considerations of the various stakeholders involved. It's interesting. You know, the best way to solve what they consider or what they dub the climate crisis, as we know, is with innovative technologies and figuring out how to provide that good regulatory framework so that can happen. And unfortunately, too much of this has really focused on finding those technologies and going all in on them. And this goes against the principle that we are very passionate about, and that is technology neutrality. The idea that we're going to have a technology that is favored by a governmental institution, that various subsidies will be given, is usually not in the interest of consumers, because there are always new technologies that are ready to compete, that are actually much more efficient, that will be more low cost, and will provide much better methods of getting towards that carbon-free future that they claim to want to achieve by 2030. So with Bill Gates' investment vehicle, we'll have to see how this plays out. There's going to be a lot of money at play. There are probably going to be larger budgets required because of this. We would hope that it would spur new innovation. However, there is already all types of innovation that's happening. I mean, if we just look at the space of plastics and plastic recycling, of taking those different polymers and breaking them down, there's a lot of innovation there. It's not usually the focus. Usually the focus is in various bans and restriction on consumer products, and that hurts people like you and me. It hurts small businesses and companies that are providing us goods and services. But something like this, we'll have to wait and see. We'll have to see how the impact will actually be on ordinary people, ordinary taxpayers, ordinary consumers, and in the products that they buy. So next, I want to play a clip. This is from an interview that we conducted with Danish political scientist and also president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center, Bjørn Lomborg. He's written several books on climate science and economics, and he's the author of the newly released False Alarm: How Climate Change Panic Cost Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. This interview ran on Consumer Choice Radio, our sort of North American offshoot radio program that's broadcast on two different radio stations and also available as a podcast. So let's listen in on Bjorn, and then we'll come back and end the program here on Consumer.
It's very clearly a real problem. It's human-made, and it is something that we should fix. But, and that's the main point here, we should not be so alarmed about it as we are. If you look at, if we remember back before Corona, kids across the world were terrified about this. Washington Post survey shows that 57% of all kids are alarmed about climate change. And if you ask people around the world, so a survey from YouGov of 28 nations showed that on average, almost half the world's population now believes that global warming will likely lead to the extinction of the human race. Look, that's just way beyond being reasonably concerned about a problem. That is being falsely alarmed. So we honestly believe that the world is going to end, whereas what the UN climate panel actually tells us, so the guys who write the gold standard report for the UN for everyone on what's climate about, they tell us that by about 50 years from now, in the 2070s, the average impact of climate change will be negative, and it will be equivalent to each one of us losing somewhere between 0.2 and 2% of our income. Remember, by the 2070s, each person is estimated to be about 2.63 times as rich as we are today. So almost three times richer. And because of global warming, instead of being 2.63 times richer, we'll only be 2.56 times richer. Now, that is a problem. It is just not the end of the world, and it's certainly not justified to believe we're all going to die.
And Bjorn, one thing that I noticed in your book is you use a lot of models and cost-benefit analysis, which is something very normal for every large problem that we're trying to solve collectively. But it seems in the climate debate on the climate crisis, as it is called, it's never really taken into consideration, and even you're sometimes attacked for using that kind of model. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, it's because it gives the wrong answer, right? If these global economic models showed us we should put everything and the kitchen sink into this in order to solve it because it would actually be a good deal, everyone would be quoting them. But the point is, the cost-benefit analyses have been made, and they've mostly been led by a guy called William Nordhaus from Yale University, who actually got the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. He's the first climate economist to get the Nobel Prize. What he spent his career on doing and helped a lot of other people do is basically say, look, how much is it going to cost us to do climate policies, smart climate policies? And how much is it going to help us? And not surprisingly, what he finds is we should do some, but not everything. If you do a little bit, it's fairly cheap and it'll help a lot. If you do everything, it's going to be very expensive and it'll actually not help all that much more. That's why he finds there's an equilibrium, which most economists come out with. But he gets viciously attacked, and my book is to a large extent based on his findings, because it doesn't give the right answer. But of course, not liking the answer is not the same thing as not actually listening to it. It's the exact same thing that most climate alarmists tell us. You can't just ignore the climate science. No, absolutely we can't. The climate science tells us there's a real problem with global warming, but the climate economics also tells us very clearly, while there's a big problem with climate, there's also a big cost to trying to tackle it. We need to balance those two. That's unpopular, but it's necessary if we're actually going to manage this.
So I have to give some praise to my colleague Bill Wietz, a typical host of this program, as he often mentions. If you want to have more of the taxes or the various EU-targeted climate taxation regimes, you're going to have more people protesting. If you have more people who are trying to achieve that carbon zero future just by these various taxation on industries or on people, fuel prices will go up and you'll get more yellow vests, as we saw with the Gilets Jaunes in France. And we saw exactly what happened when the people were rising up because they had to pay these exorbitant costs. I think that's an important point to mention and something that's not often looked at is how does this actually impact you and me? It mostly means in many circumstances from some of the fixes that are proposed that we're going to end up costing more. And of course, that's justified because it is seen as such an impending doom and an impending crisis. And that's what Bjorn covers here as well.
We are constantly being told this is the end of the world. And then obviously, you're just going to throw everything at it. I mean, if this was a meteor hurtling towards Earth, we should just, you know, send Bruce Willis up there and deal with it and give him all the money he could possibly use, right? But the reality is, this is a problem. This is like diabetes, something we need to fix and maintain and make smart choices on. But we also have to fix everything else, like the roads and the healthcare system with Corona and, you know, the education system, and all these other things. So to give you a brief answer, it is astounding. If you think back in 2015, the world agreed to the Paris Accord, which was essentially assuming to fix climate change. It's the biggest treaty we've ever done. It's also the costliest treaty we've ever done. You would imagine somebody to actually analyze, so how much is this going to cost and how much is this going to do? The answer is no, they haven't. And for very obvious reasons, because it doesn't do very much and it costs a lot. So briefly, the impact, if every nation actually does what they promised in the climate, the Paris Accord, we don't, and we're nowhere near on track to that. And obviously Trump has tried to pull the US out. But if you assume everyone tries to do this, the UN, the guys who actually organized the meeting, so the UNFCCC, they actually once did this calculation. It came out with the politically incorrect answer. That's why they've never done it again. But they found it. How much will we actually reduce our emissions? It turns out that it's about 63 billion tons of CO2. Now, to most people, that doesn't mean anything. But just to give you a sense of proportion, if we're going to make the 1.5 degree target, we have to cut about 6,000 gigatons or billion tons of CO2. So we're literally promising with the Paris Agreement to reach 1% of that goal. And of course, we're not on track to even do that. So the Paris Agreement is a tiny bit of the way towards fixing climate change. However, so if you translate that into temperature, it means that the temperature by the end of the century will be reduced by about 0.05 degrees. So that's not very much. It's a tiny bit, but not very much. The cost to the Paris Agreement, again, there's no official estimates, but there's lots of academically very valid studies. The best come from the Stanford Energy Modeling Forum, which brings together a lot of the best period energy economic models. What they find across the US, Europe, China, and a few other nations, and then it's scaled up to the rest of the world, is that the cost will be somewhere between $1 to $1 trillion a year. So 1 to 2% of global GDP. So we're basically talking about spending an enormous amount of money, not the end of the world money, but enormous amount of money to do something that by in 80 years, we can't tell the difference. Not surprisingly, it turns out that's not a good idea. If you do the cost benefit, every dollar spent will avoid about 11 cents of climate damage. That's a bad deal. And that's, you know, the point that I try to make. This is not rocket science, but it's just surprisingly how we don't want to hear this this message.
This is great. This is Bjorn Lomborg, who was interviewed on our program here some months ago. Really gave some great insight as to what is at stake in the climate debate, what is the future of the climate crisis, and the various things that are being discussed both in the European Union and around the world. So thank you guys for tuning in here to Consumer. It was great to sit in the chair that my colleague Bill Wietz normally has, and hope you guys enjoyed it. Please continue to listen, subscribe, share with your friends, give us a rating in the App Store, and we'll be back with more great content next week. I love